Blog Talk Radio.
Such a great guy. Rick, hello. Randy,
hello.
Welcome to the show.
Howdy.
Welcome, Randy.
Hey.
Oh, boy. Randy Blazak, what a pleasure to host you. The last time we were together, God, this is going to really go up into the big years, isn't it, Randy?
Oh, yeah.
Randy was a bachelor professor, and he invited me to lecture, well, to do a talk, not lecture, that's a European term, forgive me, to do a talk to his sociology class at Emory University, Rick. So this was a fun meeting for me. I was very honored to be asked, and Randy's students were unbelievable. Randy, please, I mean, tell us how.
Yeah, you know, that was, I was just thinking about that this morning. I'll never forget it because you wore a pink jumpsuit to class with your, you know, flaming hair and full of energy and delighting the students with stories about Iggy Pop and David Bowie. And it was you were my first guest speaker in a class that I ever had. It was a class called Youth Subcultures, and I still teach it to this day. It's about sort of the evolution of youth culture and how we understand the changes. And of course, a big part of it is the punk rock world that I came of age in. And so it was such a big deal to have Angie Bowie come and talk to the class. And then the next year when I taught it, the guest was Peter Buck from REM, who's a friend of mine. And it was right when the Losing My Religion song went to number one. And so word started getting out that if you take this class, you know, there's going to be a rock star showing up at some point. And I had to start bringing the expectations down. I didn't know. I thought maybe they thought Elvis Presley was going to walk into the next class. So it was really exciting to have you kick off that great tradition of that class. And I think those students are probably still talking about it.
Oh, you are so kind. I really enjoyed it. I was complimenting you. Thank you. It was a fun thing. I had lectured at Eton when I was about 20. And so I think there'd been about 25, 30 years gap, whatever, you know what I mean, before I did it again with you. And it was so much fun. I wanted to ask you, so please explain I knew you left Atlanta, but I wasn't aware of when. Please fill me in on the bits I've missed.
That date that you made that appearance was the spring of 1989. So that we go back a ways. I finished up my PhD at Emory in 1995 and had to get a grown-up job, and so I ended up coming out to Portland, Oregon, and getting a position at Portland State University, where I am at this moment here in Portland. And so, you know, a few things have happened between then and now, but then we can probably talk about some of that. But, you know, I headed west, and, you know, if we think about 1995, the world is just kind of catching on to the internet. There starts to become a kind of a hotline between cities where different things were happening. So it was clear in Atlanta that there was also a cool scene in Portland, that Portland wasn't just sort of a rainy place where, you know, loggers lived. It was a place where there was a thriving art scene. And so there was kind of this underground railroad of folks, and then was starting to make waves on the internet, and that Portland seemed like the next place to be. So I headed out here, and of course Portlandia is now, you know, well known as a place for young creatives, where young people come to retire, as the song goes. And it's an amazing place to do creative things.
Hmm. Well, now, Randy, let me ask you, did you meet your wife there, or did she go with you across country?
Well, there's been more than one wife in this story, as life would have it.
Oh, forgive me. I did not mean to. Sorry. Back off.
That's all right. You know, this is how life goes,
so
right?
Sorry.
You're allowed to have a starter marriage, as I called it, where you get to figure out what it's all about. So there was someone that came out with me. Who, it's funny because there's actually, thanks to that particular person, Mr. David Bowie was given $6 million because of me. There's a whole story there you might want to hear that I always think is quite funny.
Well, I'd
and
love to hear
I'll
it.
Tell
don't
it.
Torment me.
I'll tell it now. I'll tell it now. So there is a great, well-known advertising firm in Portland known as Wieden & Kennedy, and they do some of the great innovative ads that you've seen over the years. And so she had a job working, and she actually got a job there as a temp, and then got a job in licensing. And she called me up one day, and she said, Randy, what's that great David Bowie song that you really love? And I'm like, oh, which one? There's millions. She said, the one that you were just singing yesterday. And I said, oh, Heroes, that's the song that I was singing yesterday. She said, well, sing it. And I started singing. She said, hold on a second, I'm going to put you on the speakerphone. And I started singing it. And then I heard all these voices say, yeah, that's the one. And then they ended up licensing that song from David for a Microsoft ad for $6 million. And I had sort of this mixed feeling, because you know how it is when your favorite song ends up in a commercial. Right.
I know.
When I hear a Who song that I love being used in a shoe commercial, I want to shoot myself.
Yeah.
So that I was complicit in that process killed me. That he got money out of it was great. I didn't get any money out of it also made me sad. So I feel like, you know, part of that $6 million should have come to me. But somehow now, thanks to the world of music licensing. Yeah, right, exactly. So
you know, something.
So I will say that that's the reason that we're no longer married, but it may have been a factor in that.
Yes, well, probably one has an inner childlike resentment when one contributes a great deal. It's just something that happens, and one gets totally childish, and you think, oh, poo.
Right.
No one thought of me. What about me? I helped.
Yeah.
I know what you mean.
And also the feeling that that's my song. You're taking my song and putting it in a Microsoft commercial.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah, that is a weird feeling.
So my present wife, who's a fabulous artist, incredibly talented, and the mother of our mutantly awesome child, she's from Mexico, and her story is an amazing story. She's one of these people that Donald Trump would like to throw out of the country because she came here illegally. Yes, she crossed the border when she was 8 years old, and fortunately now has a green card, so I think she's safe from Mr. Trump for now.
Yeah.
And we met. This is, you know, part of the story. I mean, people often meet where.
No, I want
where,
the story. I want to hear all this. Come on.
You
man. Want
to hear this? Okay. So this is part of a larger story that relates to the book, my new novel that will be out a little bit later this year. So it sets up the drama that is my life. So we can get into the rock and roll talk, but briefly, you know, people often meet at work. I'm a university professor, and she was a student in one of my intro sociology classes, which are these huge, you know, 100 people class, and I didn't really, other than noticing that there was a beautiful, you know, brown-skinned woman in my class, I didn't really take much mind of it. And then after the class was over, I ran into her in a nice little bar in Portland called Dante's, where a singer named Storm Large often sings, and she was singing that night. And it was a rainy night, and she told me that she really enjoyed the class. She bought me a shot of tequila, and then she asked if I wanted to go out. And I said, you know, I don't date students. It's really not cool. And then she bought me another shot of tequila. And I said, well, maybe. Yeah, maybe. Let me think about it. And then I thought about it and I said, no, I really can't. And then, you know, then we went out for a glass of wine, I think a week later. And that was it. Then we, you know, we,
that was
I just
it.
Fell
that
in love with
history.
Her. Yeah. It starts with tequila, especially if you're involved with a Mexican woman, it's going to start with tequila. So that's the beginning of that story, which is ongoing.
Wow. And what an incredible culture. I've never been more impressed in my life when I stood in Mexico City in the biggest plaza I have ever been in my life. And I've been in a lot of plazas around the world. I stood there and I looked at it and I thought, people just don't have the faintest idea what an incredible country Mexico is. You know, it's just drop-dead beautiful. What a gorgeous place. I mean, Sorry. I go off on these things. You know how.
No, I have to say this because as someone who traveled extensively in Europe, I always sort of had a fear of Mexico. You know, I'd been to Tijuana and things like that, but Mexico City to me just seemed like something from a 1930s gangster movie. And then when I finally went, I just absolutely fell in love with it. I love Mexico City so much. You know, I love to go to Frida's house and Cafe de Cuba, and it's just wonderful. And she's from southern Mexico in a beautiful city called
Michoacan,
which is kind of, oh, yeah, fantastic. And it's just, and the people are so generous.
Amazing.
And,
yes.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, how lucky. Oh, what a lucky gal. Please give her our best. I'm so excited. This is so nice, Randy, that you're talking about your family life. It's so fun. Thank you.
Well, it's, you know, I am someone, so I'm 52, I just turned 52, and I waited, and some of my friends started becoming grandparents, which is kind of freaky, and I thought, well, maybe I should go down this road. It's the one thing I haven't really done, and when Andrea and I first started dating, we were out, and I think it was our second date, and there was just such an incredible chemistry. We were sitting at a bar, which is much of our early relationship involved sitting at a bar. We're sitting at a bar, and I just said, we're going to have kids together, aren't we? And she just said, yeah, we are. So I realized it was time to find out what that thing was all about, that whole parenthood thing. And boy, has it been transformative and mind-blowing. And I mean, just yesterday, so my child is 19 months. She likes to walk, and so we go out on walks. And babies are on acid. It's the only way I can describe it. Everything is so new to them. And we were walking down the street, and there was a parking cone on the sidewalk, an orange parking cone. And she just stopped and looked at it and stared at it, tried to figure out what it was, and then she kissed it.
What? How
and I
very
thought,
sensible.
You know, what? I know. I thought, what, you know, what a mind, what it must be like to have this mind where everything is completely new. And for me to be able to see the world through those eyes is better than drugs.
You're a lucky man.
Well,
when you make a plan for your life, which you did, and it works out. Now you're getting a chance to taste every aspect of it. I think that's called good planning.
Well, I'm glad that I finally did it. I don't know. It's sort of like there's that great line in It's a Wonderful Life where Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed are trying to kiss, and the old guy on the porch says, "Oh, youth is wasted on all the wrong people." Like, I don't think I could have appreciated this when I was 21 years old, this amazing experience that now I have sort of a perspective on how significant it is. So I'm not that I want to encourage everybody to wait to the last possible minute to have children. The world might, suffer from that. But I know for me, waiting made it a very different experience.
Yeah. I can imagine that. I had a weird idea that I should have my children quickly so that I could relate to them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
My parents were much, much older. My mother got pregnant with me by mistake, apparently. In those days, they didn't think that a woman who was 43 could get pregnant. So, I don't mean everybody. Sensible doctors probably knew, but the general population was not aware
right.
that, there wasn't a magical birth control switch that went with age. And so my mother got pregnant, and my father was horrified. Horrified!
Oh,
he had a plan, and it certainly didn't include my mother getting pregnant at 43. So, it's a weird thing that goes on, and you waiting was probably great. You appreciate it more. Sometimes when one is very young, we're so busy in our hunger to achieve that we don't take time for the great moments and to relish them, do we?
Yeah, and related to that, I think, is you're just so focused on yourself. You really have to turn over your ego to your child. And there was this moment, there are all these moments, I think, that come along with parenthood. But when we were getting ready, we were going down the road of a natural birth with a midwife. And so we were at the midwife, and the first time we heard the baby's heartbeat, it was, I can't even imagine. I mean, I had some great moments in my life, but it was almost like there was this great whooshing sound. And then all of a sudden, it became super clear to me that my life was not about me. It was about this heartbeat and protecting this heartbeat and nurturing it for the rest of my life. And it was just like this switch just went off.
So this is
and it was no longer about me
Blazak,
anymore.
Randy Blazak became Citizen Universal, Uber Citizen, Uber Father.
It was so clear in that moment. It was just the most amazing thing. It was just like, oh, okay, I don't matter anymore. I mean, obviously, I matter, but the priority just went away from this sort of egotistical, what's on my bucket list kind of thing, to just making sure this baby and this child and this person was okay.
Yeah, that's right. It's so fascinating. So I don't want to monopolize you, Randy. I'm sorry, Rick. Did you have any specific questions you'd like to ask Randy before we move on? Because I want to get into all the politics of academia. So before we go there, Rick, may I ask you other questions? Because Rick is studying psychology as well as fine arts, so I'm deferring to my more intellectual and educated co-host for input here.
I was also a single parent, so
right.
It's really interesting to hear your viewpoints on this, Randy. I just love kids anyways, but it is amazing to see the world through their eyes, that's for sure.
And there is this thing, I think of it as a sociologist and how we used to think of children as just little adults, and we treated them like little adults, including throwing them in prison. But we know now so much about cognitive development, how the brain evolves, and, where it starts. When the baby was on her way to being born, we had all these little markers. Okay, now she's the size of a kumquat. Okay, now she's the size of a pear, right? And all that development, there's a little brain percolating in there. But we know that mean, I don't know the exact numbers. I've written them in my blog, but, you know, the brain sort of doubles in size the first year, and there's this huge explosion. And when the language skills start coming on, you know, Cozy has about 12 words now. You know, they're just firing, and the synapses are growing and growing. And you know, I was reading this amazing thing when she was little that they don't think that babies dream because they don't have enough experience to dream. So what happens while they're sleeping is their brain is just growing and growing and growing. And it's just an incredible thing to watch. Like the first time she could put her hand through the sleeve of her shirt, right, to do that, I didn't have to do it, that she could push her fist through the sleeve and see her hand at the other end. It was just, you know, it's like, again, it's like being on acid or something. The look on her face was like, wow, like my hand came out of the end of the sleeve. So there's just so much to experience as a parent, and it's just as a spectator of this incredible brain development, that when you really pay
You're
attention
so cute.
To it. Well, I'm in love with her, and I'm in love with the process. Yeah, a little Cozy.
Logic and intellect flew out the window. Randy got downed by Cozy.
Yes, for sure. Well, so I've started this blog. You know, I started this blog shortly after she was born to kind of chronicle parenthood and the idea of trying to raise a girl in a patriarchal society. So it's called Watching the Wheels, Feminist Fatherhood. But it's all, you know, also I live in this crazy world that we live in. So, I mean, soon after I started the blog, Ferguson, Missouri happened, and the Black Lives Matter movement. So I said, well, this is the world she lives in. I should write about it. And so I started writing about the little things, you know, the little things like baby development. And I wrote a thing, you know, last week about the first time she saw her shadow and how exciting that was for her. But then I started writing about the big things, you know, the Donald Trump stories, or I wrote about Belgium on Monday, and you know, the world that she lives in and connecting the two. And it's been a great way of both chronicling her development but also the world's development while she's growing up in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where is that blog located, Randy? How can we access that so we can tell all our listeners?
Yeah, it's called Watching the Wheels. You could Google Watching the Wheels Randy Blazak or Randy Blazak blog.
Right.
It's on WordPress.
On WordPress.
And I can,
okay, good.
Yeah. So I can send you the link.
I'll get the link and make sure to post it to everyone. I'm not –
It's always
I'm
interesting to
here.
Look at – on WordPress, one of the things that you can do is look at the search items that people have used to find your blog. It might say something like Donald Trump is a racist. Some people found my blog that way.
Right.
I looked recently, and one of the search items was how to hold breath during sex, which I'm not quite sure how that brought somebody to my blog, but I did write. So I have some blogs, some posts that are more popular than others. The Donald Trump ones are really huge, but I posted one about this sort of secret that is not much discussed, which is when your partner is nursing, sometimes you have to help her out. And, you know, sometimes someone is engorged or there's a blocked milk duct or you need some milk for your coffee, or, I mean, there are all kinds of things that, you know, that are part of the intimate relationship of a couple who is nursing a baby that often don't get talked about. And so I posted something, you know, I came out, you know, like I have probably put on a few pounds because of, you know, the fact that I'm drinking more than soy milk these days. And I wrote this blog about it, and I just thought, you know, this is just something that I think probably a lot of fathers know about. And of course it became hugely popular, and it became hugely popular among parents. But I think it also became hugely popular among some kind of weird people based on the, you know, the sexual fetish around lactation, that it went off in a very strange direction that I didn't quite expect. So, you know, I'm happy when I have a blog hit that has, you know, 1,000 views, and that one's probably at about 80,000 views at the moment. So, which doesn't compare
to
the Trump
big.
ones. Yeah, I know. The Trump ones are a quarter of a million, so those ones are really big. So Trump is beating out boobs at the moment.
Oh, you are
not
maybe
my
I
book.
Should combine. Maybe I should combine them somehow, Trump and boobs, and then you know I'll be in the stratosphere.
Yeah.
Or boobs singular.
I make a suggestion here. I think we'll take a little break. We're going to play some music, and because of our conversation having so much to do with time, and the way time affects children, the way time affects adults, and the way time affects friends. That we're still friends, though it's been so many years since we've seen each other. This is Dana Gillespie singing Timeless. Enjoy.
Money can't buy what I really need. Satisfied till my soul is free to love you like I was born to do. Oh, it feels like I'm coming home to you. Your love is
your love is true.
high.
Ooh.
The incredible Dana Gillespie, smooth and mellow.
And she'll be on next week.
Yeah, she sure will. And Randy, I want to ask you about your books. I'm so proud of you. I just get so excited when I see all the wonderful stuff you've been doing. And, you know, I never realized how much proximity you had in interests. I had no idea about this whole rock and roll connection that you laid out for me in my liner notes here.
Well, you know, it's life never goes on a straight line, I think. And you know, I've been lucky to have a lot of adventures. And as an academic, you have to write your research up. So, and we can talk about kind of my weird research area and the places that's taken me. But I grew up as a rock and roll kid and was lucky enough to kind of engage in that world. And also, you know, becoming a fan of writing. So I grew up in a little town called Stone Mountain, Georgia, which I know you know. It's just outside of Atlanta. And
yes,
in the
I sure do.
70s,
I did a video
was,
there.
Yeah, in the 70s, it was kind of very rural. Now it's just sort of a suburb of Atlanta, but it was kind of a rural place when I was a kid. And you would hear about music. So, and I have to explain to my students that there was a time before the internet, and there was a time before cable TV, and there was a time when music was kind of hard to find. So I think about things like, you know, the beatniks or punk rock and all that stuff you would hear about, but you didn't really know where to find it. There was no Google or there was no MTV. And so it was a very scarce commodity to get. I knew what punk rock looked like before I ever heard it from the rock magazines that I would read. And I remember reading a Cream magazine about this strange place called CBGB's and this band called the Ramones. And they just seemed so much different than Yes and Led Zeppelin and all the big rock bands that we were supposed to be listening to. And I was just so intrigued. So that started me on a path. And so there's the music version of that. And then the writing version of that were books like Jim Carroll's Basketball Diaries or Jack Kerouac's On the Road. You know, these things that were mentioned by the people. And this is in the time when people read Rolling Stone magazine. I always think when, you know, Joni Mitchell sings about people reading Rolling Stone, you know, it was a big deal to read Rolling Stone, and you would read the interviews with your favorite rock stars. And part of that would be them talking about the things that influenced them. So if you liked Eric Clapton, that meant you had to find out who Robert Johnson was. And, you know, you would kind of search out the source material. So some of that were these writers that I kept hearing about. And that started me on a path of, you know, imagining being a writer. And in the so then there's this overlap. You know, everybody's life is just such a complicated spider web of intersections. So part of my part of the story has to do with a group that was popular in the 1980s called the Bangles, and they played at a show
a second,
in Atlanta.
Wait a second, Randy. One minute, Randy. Okay. The Mission of the Sacred Heart. I didn't vocalize it. This is my fault. I wanted specifically to ask you to just tell us. I'm
about these books.
Fascinated at the idea that an ELO album would inspire you to write a novel with a sequel, if you please, called The Dream Police. Please, I got to understand this.
Okay. Well, so this goes back to those days, the pre-internet days when the act of listening to an album was an act in of itself. You didn't just put it on Spotify and let it play in the background. You sat in your room, you played side one, you read the lyrics, you read the liner notes, and you played side two, and it was a complete experience. And I'm always trying to encourage people to listen to albums in their entirety. So as a 13-year-old kid, I had this Electric Light Orchestra album called A New World Record, and I just loved it. It had Telephone Line and Living Things and a bunch of songs that, you know, were hits. But in my mind, as a 13-year-old boy, it was a concept album that all the songs kind of fit together and told the story of these characters. And, you know, as I'm lying in my bedroom surrounded by Kiss posters and, you know, Beatles posters, I'm imagining all these stories. And then later, when it came out on CD, I bought it, in the early 90s when it came out on CD. And I'm like, this is not a concept album. It's just a bunch of songs. But my brain kind of linked all those songs together. So later, I thought, what if someone were to write a story that used the album as sort of a template to tell the story? So I ended up writing this book called The Mission of the Sacred Heart, which is set in Portland, and it's about a sort of bunch of hipsters in Portland. And each chapter is a song from the album and somehow rooted in what's going on. So in the album, there's an opera singer, so there has to be an opera singer in the book. In one of the songs, it's something maybe from another planet, so I have a character who may or may not be from another planet in the book. And I used it, I had this whole idea of creating this new genre called the rock novel, where instead of a rock opera, it's a rock novel that's rooted in music. And so that was the starting point. And also at the time, I was going through a little bit of a blue period, not like Picasso's blue period, more like Randy's blue period, where I was having a rough time, and it had to do with the end of the relationship with the woman who sold David Bowie the song for $6 million. And so it was quite a rough period, and it took me kind of to the edge of a cliff, both metaphorically and literally. And I started, I was fortunately put in therapy. I didn't jump off the cliff, but I went into therapy, which was a wonderful thing, and started asking this question: why is it so hard for people to kill themselves? I mean, what is it about suicide? Most suicide attempts are fails, right? Or just the cry for help kind of thing. What is it that keeps us from jumping off the cliff or slashing our, and what is that thing? And I didn't really know the answer to it, but I started writing the book with that kind of as the underlying question. And by the time I got to the last chapter, which is the last song on the album, I knew the answer. Which is, there's too much to look forward to. You don't want to see how the movie ends, so you want to stick around for it. And I ended up with this wonderful story that came out of it that has all this music wrapped up into it, and it has been optioned for a screenplay in Hollywood, which I'm very excited about. So hopefully it'll make its way to the screen. And then so people started saying, and it was pretty popular. I mean, for a self-published book, it did really well. And people started clamoring for a sequel. And I, while I was doing it, I was thinking about all these other albums that I loved when I was a teenager that I had a similar experience with. And so the sequel, right, which is in the works now, is based on the Cheap Trick album, The Dream Police, which also is not a concept album, but I thought was a concept album when I was 15 years old. And so I've been writing that story, and I'm really excited about how it's turned out. It's with a publisher at the moment, and it should be out this summer sometime.
That's fantastic. I don't know about you, Rick. Rick did a lot of album covers and spent a lot of time with the Northeastern States bands during the same time frame that we're discussing, Randy. And what? I think every album is a concept album. It's a concept of the music, of the construct of those particular songwriters and musicians who came together to record it. So you're absolutely right. Your 11 and 13-year-old self was correct. They are.
Well, and sometimes I think it takes that young mind to see those connections that, we might lose when we're older.
Exactly. You were fresh and new, just like you described Cozy and the Shadow, Cozy and the Parking Cone. What you did was the creative part of you before you became an academized, I'm just inventing new words, or a product of academia. Do you know what I mean? Because in academia, we get into this thing where there's logic and everything has to have a reason and the provenance and where it came from and the sources. But you heard it, and your mind, as they say we do when we look at things that are garbled, when the typing's not right, you made the connections and you made it flow. I think that's fascinating.
Well, and I hate that we might lose that. And so somehow, through this process of writing this rock novel thing, I'm trying to encourage or help other people go back to the things that they saw as when they were young and maybe saw them differently than they see them now. It's sort of like, you know, all those songs that you mishear the lyrics when you're a kid. There's a bathroom on the
yes.
right, you know, all those great
yes.
sort of lines. Sometimes it's better that way than what it actually is. I don't want to know what all those old REM songs actually say, because the lyrics in my mind are perfect, even though I'm completely wrong about them. I mean, think about how many kids have Smells Like Teen Spirit wrong over the last 20 years. It doesn't really matter. It's sort of what it made them think about.
No, what's important was that at that point they were a team effort, singing in harmony.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I used to watch it at rock concerts of David's. And it was so incredible. It came to a point, we were at Haddon Hall, and David said, well, I don't know, the show seemed to be going really well. And I said, yes, I said, it's almost like it's time for a hymn or an anthem.
Oh, yes.
And he looked at me and he started laughing. And I turned around, and as I was going out the door, I flung my hands up in the air and I went, give me your hands! And he said, you know I'm using that.
Yep. Well, you know, that was the thing I wrote about. And, you know, I wrote, after David passed, I wrote a blog about the impact and you know, especially the song Rock and Roll Suicide, and how there were so many of us who were looking for that hymn, who were looking for that anthem, you know, the kids who are marginalized. So, you know,
you're
something as simple. Yes.
You're
just, that, just a line.
It's funny, isn't it, how we can... You're right. It's just, it's fascinating. I was thrilled when I was reading this, how you took, and hearing you talk about, you know, how you'd listen to them, how you kind of came from Cleveland to Stone Mountain to Emory and through punk and crying and driving and all that good stuff.
Yeah, driving and crying, right.
Oh, driving and crying, sorry. That reminds me of the story when my friend Connie Filippello was becoming a very big ho-ho PR in London. And she called me up, and she's from Sicily, and she has the most wonderful accent. And so she was telling me all about this band that she was doing the PR for. And my lead guitarist, Chico Ray, came over, and he said, what's going on? I said, I don't know. I said, I just talked to Connie. She's in such great shape, and she needs us to do this, this, and this. And I said, he said, oh, well, what's she doing? And I said, she's representing for the PR some band called Worm. And Chico said, Worm? There's no band called Worm. Oh, you mean Wham? I was like, oh.
I like Worm better.
Okay. Forgive me. Driving and crying.
Yes.
Now, didn't you manage them for a while?
I did. In fact, I took time off of graduate school to be a, you know, a rock business guy. It was great. I mean, it ties into a lot of the other rock and roll stories I have, including my relationship with U2. But I took off, you know, they were a local band that I sort of followed from their roots, and the bass player was my roommate, and their first show, I think, was in our apartment. There's a great documentary about them called Scarred But Smarter that people should check out, about sort of the rise and fall of a popular regional rock band. So, you know, we had a record that was very popular on MTV, and it was a very exciting thing when we went from kind of a smaller band to an MTV band. I'll never forget, we moved from a traveling by tour bus by a van to tour bus, and our first tour bus was Cher's old tour bus. Which we really made it when we were in Cher's tour bus. And I had this feeling every time there was a little bathroom on there, and I would always think about Cher's tattooed ass sitting on that toilet, that we had shared the same toilet seats, that this is it. We've made it.
You are a funny
yeah.
boy. Now, Randy, another question that I'm dying to ask. Rick, I'm not giving you a chance to say anything, am I?
That's all right. I'm enjoying listening.
Randy, please, tell us about all this stuff, these books, Teenage Renegade, Suburban Outlaws. Now, you, as you hinted a moment ago, you are schizoid. I mean, you're an academic, yeah. but you're also a rock and roll creative person. And that's so brilliant because they should be one and the same. I mean, 2,000 years ago, right, all the great teachers were like artists that have studios and have kids that come and work with them and all that good stuff. And that's who you are. What happened? What happened with all these skinheads and the chair of the Oregon Coalition Against Hate Crime? Please tell us.
Yeah, you know, I mean, right, first of all, I have to say that, you know, when I was 22 or 23, I was really lucky that all my friends were performers and making, you know, amazing
yes.
music and having audiences. And I have a great love of music, but I'm the least musically talented person in the world. And for me, the classroom became my audience and my performance
right.
space. And I felt like, yes. you know, I felt a certain kinship with all my friends in the performing world that I was doing sort of the same thing. And so, often my classes take on the air of some strange performance art project. So I felt like there's a great overlap that you can be a rock and roller and in front of the classroom at the same time. So
absolutely.
That wasn't a problem. So the thing about the skinheads and first of all, Stone Mountain, this town that I grew up in, is sort of famous, besides the big rock that sticks out of the ground. Some people know Stone Mountain because it's mentioned in Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, and there's a great part in it where he's really going. He says, "Let freedom ring from Stone Mountain in Georgia." And when I was a kid, I just thought, wow, that my hometown is mentioned in this famous speech. And then I found out the reason he mentioned my town is it's the birthplace of the Ku Klux Klan. And as a kid, I thought every town had a Ku Klux Klan. I didn't think my town was special. And so when I went off to college and kind of got a clue or took out a loan on a clue, which is finally paid off, I started to see the world from a very different perspective. And, you know, I grew up around the Klan and had friends whose dads were in the Klan. And, you know, it was just sort of normal business in Stone Mountain in those days. And so as a sociologist, you know, it was sort of clear that that was the thing that I should study since it's the place that I came from. And so in the 1980s, this new hate group emerges, which are the skinheads that kind of came over from England. It didn't really start off as a racist thing, but by the time it got to America in the 80s, it was. And I was a part of a little gang in Atlanta called the Mods. We rode around on Vespa scooters and, you know, listened to The Who and old soul music and wore Air Force parkas in the sweltering Atlanta heat, which was crazy. And we would often have run-ins with the skinheads. And so at one point, the skinhead stole my Vespa scooter and set it on fire. And I was crushed because it was this, it was this beautiful, you know, had chrome wheels on it. It was just the best scooter in all of Atlanta. And so I thought, how am I going to get these guys back? I know I will study them for the rest of my life. That'll teach them. So it started me on this vector of trying to understand what this new phenomenon was of this new hate group. And so I, as a graduate student at Emory, I did what was at first an undercover study. I spent 13 months with a group of skinheads in Orlando, Florida, kind of living among the natives, trying to understand what makes them tick and why they chose to be, you know, skinheads instead of glam rockers or skateboarders or all the other subcultures.
What were the three best reasons that you could figure that they wanted to
be violent? So that's the thing. So the main thing was the shift in the economy. This is in the days of Reaganomics and a lot of manufacturing jobs leaving the country. So, you know, the middle class was disappearing, and the only people that were explaining it to them were these older groups like the Klan and the neo-Nazis who were saying it's the Jews, it's affirmative action, it's immigration, lots of stuff that you're going to hear at a Trump rally. So so join us and we'll get America, we'll make America great again. And so that was the genesis was mainly economic. And then I continued that study onto my dissertation and added another component to it, which is it's a very hyper-masculine movement. These are all guys. They love violence.
Right.
And their issues around race are really around gender, that they're worried that black men will take their women, or they're worried that Jewish bosses will fire them from their jobs, or they're worried that, you know, gay guys will make a pass at them. And it really comes about their masculinity. So I kind of, in that process, process became sort of a feminist and understanding this through a gendered lens. And so that was that study that was wrapped up with, you know, me being awarded my PhD, but I continue to study these folks into the 21st century.
Randy, I think it's a really important mission and a great part of your character and your productivity, the output. I mean, I'm really impressed because, Rick, you know what I mean. Here's a dude who's got two rock and roll novels and also at the same time, as you had to do, I'm sure, with your degrees, preparing all this stuff, basically for fellow teachers and professors, you know, to impress them that you are educated and evolved enough to join their ranks. So I think this is it's fascinating, Randy, and thank you so much. Do you guys realize, I cannot believe this, I usually manage our time better. This has been so fascinating. We only have 9 minutes left. I can't believe it. I just looked at the clock. I was just thinking to myself, oh, good. Now we'll go back and talk about Randy growing up and what, you know. There's no time for that. I want to ask you, Randy, what the important messages that you would like to give to the audience, especially please mention your blog, because I am so impressed with the numbers. I wish you'd mention us on your blog. Please do.
Oh, well,
it's coming up.
Well, important messages for the world or just for Randyland?
No, for Randyland,
you know,
and for the world, because Randyland.
Okay, well, so just the plug for me to get it out of the way. So the Mission of the Sacred Heart is available. The easiest way to find it is on Amazon, but it might be in your local bookstore. It's available, the Kindle e-version and the paperback version, and then this summer the Dream Police will be out. There's a Facebook page for the Mission of the Sacred Heart you could probably find.
Cool.
And you can follow me on Twitter, which will have all the news on R. Blazak. That's also a way. And the usual things. I mean, I have a weird enough name that it's easy to Google me, which sometimes is a little scary what comes up on Google, especially when you have a lot of neo-Nazis who hate you and want to destroy you. So sometimes I'm shocked when I Google myself.
So you
can imagine. I mean, I'm sure you have the same thing, Angie. You know, if you ever, like, have a little bit of time on your hands and you Google yourself.
I refuse to go there. I don't Google myself. Yeah. I don't Google anything to do with me. Uh-uh.
That's probably a good policy. Yeah, it's a little rough for me.
Yeah, I don't watch anything. I never read my interviews. I never watch my stuff on TV or anything, ever.
Well, but the larger message, the larger message for
the larger
world,
message,
you know.
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I mean, I was just thinking about your most recent book, Angie, and kind of the importance of talking about gender. And so this has become a theme in my work, is talking about gender and understanding the role that gender power plays, you know, that we still live in a world that has sexual violence against women and unrealistic standards, and that women have less time because they're working and making dinner. I mean, I know all this is a stay-at-home dad. And so, you know, I just challenge people to think about the importance of things like race and gender and not be to have dialogues with people that aren't like them. You know, so, for example, one of the big things that's going on is the reaction against the Black Lives Matter. And when people say, well, all lives matter, I'm like, that's the point, is that all lives matter, including Black lives. But if you have a conversation with someone who is a Black Lives Matter person, you might learn something. And, you know, I've learned so much as a man, as a straight white male, shutting up. But I know after this show, it made me hard to believe that I ever shut up. But shutting up and listening to people who are gay, listening to people who are female, listening to people who are not white about their experiences, and listening from the heart instead of, you know, a position of being defensive and saying, well, no, it's not like that. Just really opening your heart to those conversations. And my journey is really sort of that process, including listening to racist skinheads and kind of what are their issues. And so I think the world would be a better place if we got a little less defensive and just walked a few feet in somebody else's shoes once in a while to understand those perspectives. So that's, I mean, if that's my, like, We Are the World song, that's my, you know, give me your hands anthem.
Well, you know, Randy, I am so impressed because you, it's always been, you always made me smile. And I've talked about you to folks who knew you in clubs, at dinner, in places in Atlanta, you know. And so I was always very proud of the fact that you had invited me and I told people about it. Now, I've been talking for years about Cyprus being reunited. And the problem is what you just stated. People do not want the time to get together in a room, put their feet under the table with the people they're in opposition to, and try to work it out. In Cyprus, we've been talking, the Turks and the Greeks. I hear Cozy.
Yeah, she's here.
Hey, baby. Hello, Cozy. This is your Uncle Rick and Auntie Angie. Hi.
Hello.
That's not the radio show, sweetheart.
At some point, I'll tell her that she was on the show.
Oh, I'm so excited. Anyway, let me play this for you because this is all about, I am so impressed that you did all that undercover work for the book in Florida with the skinheads. That's amazing. Hello, baby girl. So this is Cozy Mike when Cyprus becomes one. Yes, baby girl.
She's looking at herself in the mirror, so this is the beginning of it all.
What a cute little butt.
When Cyprus becomes one, I wonder what they'll have to show. When Cyprus becomes one, will they sell us out just like before? When Cyprus becomes one, and will it lead to yet more war? When Cyprus becomes one. And will you be my brother, sister, when Cyprus becomes one? Tanks and bombs litter the streets. Life is harsh, hard, bitter, sweet. Tourists love to soak the sun, drink the booze, dish out orders, make us run. And will it all be just the same? Different players playing the same game. When Cyprus becomes one. Refugees in their homes. Missing persons reunited. Weapons cast away. Living life, having a say. Natives in a native land, creating more natives for peace. You understand? Or am I asking for too much? Saying things that are out of touch? Or is it such a impossibility? Beyond the next century? Strange mystery. Mysterio Brahma. A fallacy. For Cyprus to be one. So just in case it doesn't happen, Cyprus becoming one, that is, when I die, I tell you what I want on last request. Bury me somewhere in between, in that no person's land, on that line which they call green, and there my spirit will rest and wait. To greet the date, to celebrate the time and day so great when Cyprus becomes one.
Randy, I just...
Yes.
I can't thank you enough for the most wonderful show and for you sharing so much information with us.
It's been a great thrill.
It's just been fantastic, and I can't tell you. I would love to. Please, you're very good at this. Would you run through any other links, places people can find you? There's WordPress for the blog, which is...
Yeah, the WordPress for the blog, Amazon for the book. And so, you know, that my name, Blazak, is funky enough that people can find it, Blazak. So, and then Twitter. I think those are probably the easiest ways to find out what's going on in Randyland. especially with regards to, I'm very excited about the new book, The Dream Police. I think it's really special and weird and unique, and hopefully it'll make its way through the Hollywood process, just like the mission of the Sacred Heart is at the moment. And yeah, I'd love to send you a copy of it, and get your take on it. You know,
well,
I was sort of writing about what was happening in the world. So there's a great little a part of the book where the character is having a conversation with the Station to Station album in his dream. So, you know, it's just sort of everything that was happening in the world while I was writing it popped up in the book. So I'm really proud of it.
That's fantastic, Randy. Oh, Rick, thank you so much. Cozy, thank you for showing up and deserting Sesame Street, you little angel. And Randy, come back. And maybe you'll come back in a couple of months when the book is out later in the year.
I'd love to. Yeah, that would be
fun. That would be great.
We would love it. That would be so wonderful. Thank you, everyone who listened. The Angie Bowie Barnett and Rick Hunt Show signing off with our fabulous guest, Randy Blazak. I love you, Randy. Love to cozy.
Yeah, I love you too, Angie. So great to talk to you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Randy, for being on the show.
Great meeting you, Rick. Great thrill.
Okay, everybody. Have a great Easter. Enjoy the spring.
You too, Mike.
Yes. Have fun, everybody. And thank you again, Randy.
Yes, my pleasure.
Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome, Angie. Thank you. Have a great Easter.
All right, everybody. Signing off. Arrivederla.